Welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. I'm your aptly named host. Oh, I'm glad you're with me. I'd suffer with prosopagnosia if you made me face the idea that you missed today's show. Mommy Lied to God. That's Carlos Maestas' new book. He's a story smith, and he's got tips and strategies to improve your storytelling. He's the founder of Key Ideas. Come listen, come learn. On Tony's Take Two, Planned Giving Accelerator. We're sponsored by Turn Two Communications, PR and content for nonprofits. Your story is their mission. Turn-2.co. And by Dot Drives. Raise more money, change more lives. Tony.ma/dot for a free demo and a free month. What a pleasure to welcome to the show, Carlos Maestas. He believes storytelling is the best way organizations and people can move others to action. He's the author of the book, Mommy Lied to God, Life Lessons in Authentic Storytelling. He's founder and chief storysmith at Key Ideas, helping organizations sharpen and share their messages. He's a stand-up comedian who once opened for Saturday Night Live alumnus Dennis Miller. The company is at keyideas.net and at Key Ideas Inc. Carlos is at Key Ideas Carlos. Carlos Maestas, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tony. It's so great to be with a veteran of the podcast world. I'm honored to be with you today.
Oh, thank you. I'm gratified, pleased to have you. We're gonna have some fun with storytelling. Absolutely. I have to tell you, it's a little sad for me to have to say Saturday Night Live alumnus before Dennis Miller's name. Because there was a time when that would be like saying today, you know, comedian Jim Gaffigan.
Right.
He was so well known. He was fabulous.
He did the Weekend Update for
yes,
years.
Exactly. Years. Weekend Update. Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, I grew up watching SNL probably way before I should have. You know, my mom her style was like, yeah, you're interested, like, let's stay up. And, you know, I probably fall asleep, you know, right before it started getting really bad.
When it was the Not Ready for Primetime players.
Yeah.
Gilda Radner, Dan Aykroyd, John Belushi.
Yeah, exactly.
Lorraine Newman,
and then
Morris,
Dana Carvey, you know, later, and yep, those guys, and you know, it was so much fun to watch. And so I would stay up late. I probably was up till probably the Weekend Update, and I'd fall asleep. So, you know, Dennis Miller was definitely a guy I watched. I probably didn't understand a lot of the jokes back then, but, you know, it was definitely one of the things that made me want to get into doing stand up eventually.
And how about opening for him? How did that come about?
Yeah, you know, opening for him was one of those calls you get that you're not expecting, and it happened about a week before he was coming into town. And interestingly enough, it was the same day that I had a huge presentation for a group of nonprofits, and so I had to remember what I was supposed to say in that presentation. It was called the Tech Summit, and it was happening at Rackspace in San Antonio, and there were over 200 nonprofit leaders that were going to be there for this event. And it was probably the biggest presentation I had done for nonprofits up until that point. And then that night was the show with Dennis Miller. So I was a wreck the week before. You know, I was just trying to not mix up the two presentations. and then just, you know, rehearse and try to be as prepared as I could. But I'm one of those guys that, you know, I am nervous until the minute I hit the stage, and then I'm good. And so it was just one of those calls I got, and I was like, of course I'll open up for Dennis Miller. And it was this beautiful, really beautiful theater in San Antonio called the Lila Cockrell Theater. And it's been there a really long time. Some of the biggest acts have come through and performed there. It's right on the Riverwalk. Beautiful.
How many people in the audience?
Yeah. So, I think that it was So I gauge it by how much the tickets were. Not as the tickets were like $60 a ticket.
Yeah.
And I think it was their capacity there is probably around 1500, maybe a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And it was full. I mean, it was, I don't know that it was sold out, but it was pretty close to it. I mean, cause I remember I opened for him and they started setting up seats in the front where there weren't any seats. They were like adding seats to the show. And so you had, you know, I kind of made a joke about it because you had these people that were in steerage at the top in the rafters. But they were still paying $60 a ticket. And then you had these people who must have been the VIPs that they were putting right in the front. And I was like thinking to myself, you know, you cannot bomb when someone's, you know, paying $60 for a ticket.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I did 20 minutes and I got to say it was a great set and it was really cool to meet him. One thing I can tell you, a short little story, you know, I didn't get to actually meet him until he was coming on the stage. And I believe that the group that had booked him, you know, they were used to doing, they're called Live Nation and they do a lot of concerts.
Live Nation is enormous.
Yeah. They're huge. They do
Springsteen concerts.
Yeah. Huge. But comedy is something they do less frequently. And I know the person who was in charge of this, I think it was like his first big comedy show. And so he said, if you could, finish your set. And at the end, all you have to say is, you know, Dennis Miller will be here with you shortly. And that's it. You know, say thank you and say he'll be with you shortly. And someone else is going to bring him up. And so I was like, okay, I'm like, I can't, you know, I won't mess that up.
Yeah.
And so I'm thinking there's a break between and, you know, I'm finishing my set and then I see Dennis Miller to the right and he's on stage and I'm like, oh, that's cool. He's like watching a little bit of the show. And so I do exactly what the guy says, you know, hey, thank you so much. Dennis Miller will be with you shortly. And so then I start leaving the stage and then Dennis Miller's walking on the stage. And that has to be like the worst intro you can ever do. I mean, it's the worst thing you can do. Like he's the headliner.
Yeah. If they had told you to introduce him, you know, you would have got the crowd all whipped up.
Exactly.
San Antonio, let's bring on the incredible, you know, Saturday Night Live alumni. And all you got to say was, he'll be with you shortly.
I'm the hometown guy. I'm supposed to get the hometown crowd.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then he spends the first 5 minutes of his set making fun of me because of the intro that he just got. And so he gets on there and he's like, well, thanks for whipping him up into a frenzy, Carlos. And I'm like, oh, gosh. And, you know, you got screwed.
You got screwed. Yeah. The stagehand or whoever gave you the bad direction.
I had, you know, it was my nerves and not thinking, well, maybe, you know, maybe he's going to bring him up. But yeah, the guy said, you know, just do this. And so I was thinking there's some VIP that was going to bring him
right,
up.
Right, right. There's somebody else that you don't know going to bring him on. No, you did what anybody would have done. You followed direction.
So then, you know, afterwards, I got a chance to, he was gracious enough. And I think he was doing probably like a red eye flight out. He didn't even stay. You know, I got to watch a set from the side of the stage. And then, you know, he took a picture with me afterwards and that, you know, that was it. That was,
all right.
It was quick, but you know, it was definitely one of those things that I will not forget for the rest of my life. But yeah. It's also cool to me. It was also, you know, nice that I was connected with earlier in the day, you know, what I really do for a living, which is help support nonprofits and getting a chance to, I think they probably got more out of it than the audience that was there.
They were setting up more seats in the front row because you were selling, they were selling tickets as you were on stage.
Oh yeah.
They were saying, oh, I gotta be part of this stage. I gotta be part of this show. Listen to this guy, Carlos, and he's only the opener. So
yeah,
they were selling additional seats and that's why they had to set them up in the, right in front, right up in front. There was no space left.
You
still
know,
doing stand up at all?
That's a great story. I'm going to use that from now on.
Yeah. Are you still doing stand up at all?
You know, I, not a lot of people are doing stand-up right now, you know, unfortunately. And I will do stand-up, you know, any opportunity that I get. What I'm doing more often than not is I work doing stand-up into the workshops that I do. Profits. And so I get it because it's really tied closely with my personal story, and so then I have an opportunity to do that. So it's more that than it is, you know, traveling and doing shows. But I will, you know, anytime I have an opportunity to do it, I'll jump at it.
Yeah. I weave stand up into my presentations also. I have a signature opener that I use and et cetera. So
that's great. Well, you know, comedians, and I'm sure you've learned through doing stand-up, I think the reason you're such a great communicator is that, you know, what comedians are brilliant at doing is taking people on a journey in a very finite amount of time, right? And you have a short amount of time to create an emotional response out of an audience. And, you know, they're some of the best at simplifying very complex issues. And so, you know, I think that's one of the things that I admire comics and just people who present well. They have a way of using humor that really, you know, makes a connection.
Well, and simplifying is one of your tips, of course, which we will get to. Yeah, you have to, right, you got to rarefy that, or you got to, I don't mean that. I mean, you got to narrow it down to the basics that are the most interesting, funniest, punchiest, right? And cut out the stuff that doesn't really help your case. And,
well,
and
that's right.
You got to do it in your case, 20 minutes. When I was doing stand-up, I was getting like 6 and 8 minute sets. So, you know, when you're just getting warmed up, all of a sudden the red light comes on and you're being signaled off that you got to wrap it up in 30 seconds or so. And but we're going to talk, we're going to talk about your storytelling, not mine.
That's a great lesson though, Tony, and for nonprofits or any presenter, because sometimes you only have 6 minutes. You know, yeah. You may have 6 or 7 minutes for a presentation. And what you learn to do as a comedian is you try things, and when they're not working, you should cut them out. Otherwise, you know, you're not going to get the response you want. And it's the same thing for anybody who is in charge of making presentations on a regular basis.
I think of boards exactly along the lines of what you're talking about. It's rare to get the full amount of time that you're allocated in advance at a board meeting. You know, they'll say you get 25 minutes or a half hour or 15, 20 minutes. And I've gone down to like 6 because other topics before me went over, and but we still have to finish on time, or there's a lunch deadline, or, you know, whatever. It's rare that you get the full time that you're planned. And on a fly, you know, you got to, okay, we're going to cut these slides. Well, you'll get this in print, or you have this in print. We're going to skip these because I'm now down to like a fifth of the time. But here's the most important stuff. You know,
that's
and
right.
You got to do that with like 10 minutes notice sometimes, depending on how the board meeting is running. And there are other instances of that too, but I think of board meetings as being the least likely to stay on time and they'll stay on agenda, but on time allocation, least likely, I find.
If you're down on that agenda, you're likely going to have to cut. You should just already start cutting it in half.
And I'm always the consultant anyway. I mean, the consultant is the most expendable, right? Yeah, you know, he's here, we're paying him anyway, so, you know, and we got to squeeze him in because he traveled here, but there's other stuff that's, I don't know, just seems always more important than the planned giving. I do planned giving fundraising, but the key messages, you're right, you got to boil it down to the key messages, and you're right, sometimes you got to do it on the fly.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So let's talk about you though. So you're all right, you're a raconteur, storyteller, right? And so I want you to tell your stories, tell some stories, and then we'll pick out the lessons, your tips and strategies that we can learn from different stories. But for, is that okay?
Yeah, of course.
Go that way? Okay.
Yeah, definitely.
But I want to base it around the stories, not around the strategies, but which we will cover. But I feel like I got to give you time to talk about Fred Rogers from Mr. Yeah. Rogers' Neighborhood. You revere this man as a storyteller. It's time for a break. Turn to communications. They help you build relationships with journalists. Because of a relationship built by Turn 2, the New York Community Trust got two features in the Wall Street Journal. That's what happens when you get the good relationships before you want to be heard in the media. You got the existing relationship. Turn 2 specializes in working with nonprofits. They'll help you build those relationships. One of the partners, Peter Panapento, was an editor at the Chronicle of Philanthropy. They're at turn-2.co. Now back to Mommy Lied to God. Why is that? What can we learn from Fred Rogers?
Yeah, well, I'm probably aging myself a little bit too, just that I know who he is, and watched him, you know, growing up. But you know, you when you experience something as a child, you experience it, and you don't quite know what draws you in about it. And it's not till you hear the stories behind what was a very intentional approach of how. Fred Rogers, you know, worked at connecting with kids and just how authentic he was as a storyteller. And the reason I use Fred Rogers as an example is because he was a nonprofit, right? He worked for a nonprofit.
Yeah, and so public television in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, exactly. He had to be really scrappy. And there are a lot of parallels with how he told stories that I find with what nonprofits do, because you know, he had just a small team, and he didn't have the budget that, you know, folks like Walt Disney and some of the other major studios that were producing content for kids, but he did it anyway, and he was successful at it. You know, and so, you know, one of the things, one of the lessons about Fred Rogers is the lessons in consistency and how he would open the show every time. Coming in, he would take off his suit jacket, you know, he'd put on the cardigan, take off his dress shoes, put on, and that happened. And I didn't think about it much. It's like, why is this guy changing on show? You know, you don't think about it as a kid, but what he was doing is he was creating something that, you know, kids could anticipate and expect every single time a show would start, even though the show was pretty different.
That routine is comforting.
It is comforting. It's comforting, especially when you have kids who knows how inconsistent their routine might be, right? Yeah. And their home life. And so there are little things like that that just get you comfortable with what's about to happen. And knowing that, you know, you work to build that trust with your audience. But after you have, then they, you know, they look forward to that routine. And so, you know, messaging, when you share your story and sharing a consistent message and not, you know, changing it, you can change your approach and you can change, you know, you can change the content and what you use to tell that story, but your messaging should be consistent. You should be sharing a consistent message every time. And you should try to get people feeling comfortable with who you are and what you do. And it's a lesson that you can learn with your donors, you know, because if you're establishing a relationship over a period of time, they should feel that they understand you in a way that others may not at the beginning if they've been with you for, you know, 5 or 10 years, right?
Yep. Yep.
And there's other things, you know, the one of the things I appreciate about him is that he told stories that had heavy content. But they were stories that, you know, kids were living through pure hard, you know, if he was alive today, he would for sure be doing content on the pandemic and, you know, like things that were, you know, things that were in the time really, traumatic things that were going on in our history, things like war, the threat of nuclear war, you know, Martin Luther King's assassination,
yeah.
You know, heavy things that you would think, well, we would shy away from that, you know, for a kid's show, but he figured out a way of making it safe and communicating in a way that was age appropriate for the kid. And so they left the show being better for it because it wasn't something that was just being swept under the rug, you know? And I think about my own daughter. I'm a father of 3, but I have a daughter that's 6. And, she, you know, just because we don't talk about it, if we were to not talk about what's happening with the pandemic, she's gonna have a ton of questions anyway. You know, she, for the first, you know, few months of us staying at home from school and wearing masks, you know, she was, you could feel how heavy it was for her. And she would say things like, I don't want anyone to get the Cyrus. You know, she'd say the Cyrus. It was hard to correct. I wanted to correct her. She, you know, if she was 12 and saying Cyrus, it would be different.
Yeah. The Miley Cyrus.
I don't want anyone to get those.
The Wiley virus, the Miley Cyrus. Yeah.
I don't want her to get the Miley Cyrus. So, you know, we what it did is it gave us an opportunity to just have, you know, real appropriate conversations with her.
And Fred Rogers didn't shy away from difficult subjects. He found an appropriate way to discuss them in an intimate, you know, an intimate way by reducing it to what kids needed to know. And was he still on the air on September 11th?
You know, I think he came back and did a special. I don't think he was, if I remember doing the research for this, I don't know that he was still doing the show, but he was still, you know, he was young enough to be able to come on and talk about it. And I think there was on PBS, there was some like special or interviews that he gave around that time. But he still, so what they did is they evolved the show into this Daniel Tiger's neighborhood, which is it's basic, you know, they still do kind of the same music and same theme, but it's a cartoon now. And so, yeah, I mean, I think those are the kinds of things that, you know, when you live life, there's plenty of things to celebrate, but there are also a lot of things that are just really hard. And I think that, you know, if we don't take the time to just be authentic with our kids or with who we serve or with our teams, then, you know, we're missing out on an opportunity to grow from those experiences. Yeah.
And remain relevant as well. You can't ignore what you know everybody around you is experiencing and still expect to be relevant during and afterwards.
That's,
you know,
right.
It's, if you know everybody is suffering something or celebrating something, you have to talk about it. If you have a voice, I mean, if you have a channel. Yeah. All right. So I want to get to some stories now, because this is a storytelling book. So, you know, usually I'm very dictatorial on nonprofit radio, and I'm going to throw it to you because I'm not really, well, yeah, maybe I'm dictatorial. I don't know. I like to guide the conversation. I'm a guide, not a dictator. Yeah, but you know, of course you have your signature story, but what story you want to open with? You tell a story.
Yeah. Well, you know, one lesson that I think is really important as it relates to just powerful storytelling is to seek first to understand before being understood.
Tell us a story about that.
Yeah. So there was a politician. We're in an election year, so we're hearing a lot about politicians. We're probably sick of it, but there was a politician that was running for a seat in Texas. It was his first time running as a House representative, and District 123 in San Antonio. And he wanted to run on a platform that really involved making a difference in education. You know, that's not very different, right? There's always a lot of politicians that are going to run on a platform of education, especially if it's their first time. And really specifically what he wanted to do was try to change the way that schools were financed. And I know it's different all over. In Texas, schools are financed largely by property tax, which can make it very difficult in urban areas where you have a large population of students who are in homes that are either rented or their property values are low, very low. And so the schools where there may be the most need, and it's not a maybe, it is where there is the most need, get less funding. And that's how it is. That's how it goes. And so, and you know, what to add insult to injury, this was by design. You know, if you're familiar with redlining, then you may know that, you know, we have a history in the country of banks drawing lines through communities and neighborhoods and saying, we're not going to lend in these communities because they're more at risk. And also there are, you know, the property values were, the lots were a lot smaller, and it, because they weren't lending in that area, people couldn't fix their houses up. So then the problems kept, you know, perpetuated. But in addition to that, you know, if you lived in an affluent neighborhood, it was illegal, I believe, until like the 70s to put restrictions in your deeds that your house could not be transferred to somebody of color. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it was, it created a huge issue in San Antonio. And so San Antonio has been one of the most economically segregated cities in the entire country. And so here was a man that grew up in one of these neighborhoods that was the poorest zip code in all of the county. And he wanted to make a difference, you know, and but he understood a lot because he knew how an education could change a child's life, because he went to school, he worked hard, he graduated from the University of Michigan, got a law degree, and spent a lot of time, you know, working on some of these issues, as, you know, in his work as an attorney. But he was the freshman, you know, House of Representatives for his district. And so what he did, instead of going in and just leaning on his own understanding and shaping policy, what he did is he went and visited every single school that was in his district. And it was a very diverse district. There were about 55 schools, and he met with the principals at each of those schools. And he wanted to hear their stories about where the biggest needs were. And so there were a lot of things that he learned, but I'll distill it to this one big thing. And the reason, it's kind of a personal thing, because one of the schools that he visited, my wife was a principal, and it was in the district where he grew up in, which is 78207 in San Antonio. It's been his for years and years, over 50 years, the poorest zip code in the city. And the thing that she wrote on the whiteboard under challenges, and the biggest challenge was food insecurity. And so imagine, you know, you're a leader of a school and you're trying to get kids on grade reading level and, you know, to sort of have them close gaps that exist with their learning. But you get kids that are coming to school and they're starving. Yeah. And so they're having problems focusing, they're having problems, with behavior. All of those things are connected. And so if you're the school leader, you can't really control what happens at home before they get there, but it's having an impact on your school. And so across the board, he learned that this is something that was happening in every single school that he represented. And some of the schools were in areas that were historically very impoverished, but it was happening in some of the more affluent schools as well. And so to add insult to injury, the food that they would get at that school would have to be thrown away, anything that wasn't eaten. So there was like perfectly good food that wasn't touched. I'm not talking about the stuff on people's plates, but like apples and oranges, you know, milk that wasn't open. You know, if it wasn't eaten, there were school district laws and rules, school district rules and state laws that said anything untouched, even if it was completely fine, had to be thrown away. Yeah. So here you have these hungry kids, and you have help in the same school, but because of those overlapping policies, you know, they weren't able to do anything about it. So he created the Fairness in Feeding Act. And what it did is it allowed these schools to kind of create these little pantries within the school. And it let the food service staff put out things that were not eaten for that day. If a kid had an apple and didn't touch it and wanted to put it on the share table, then any kid at any time could go up and take that food home with them. And so, you know, it got bipartisan support because it wasn't this Democrats story in a you know, a red state, right? It was this Democrat story who had visited all these schools and taken the leaders' stories, mm-hmm. and to committee, and so it got bipartisan support, and that was passed. And you know, at the time, Texas was the second most food insecure state in the entire country. And so, you know, here is like one person just taking the time to actually ask questions before he decided to you know, pitch his ideas. And it led to his second term, him being able to, he became a co-chair on the education committee. And he was able to actually pass a finance reform his second term. I think it put about $30 million into the school district that he came from. And it was a reform that was also passed by bipartisan support. And so the thing he wanted to do in the beginning, he was able to do his second term just by going in and, you know, taking the stories of the people who do the work, to the people who could make a difference.
It's time for Tony's Take Two. Planned Giving Accelerator. This is the membership community that I have created to get your planned giving program started in 2021. You'll join for a year, and I will teach you everything I know about how to get your planned giving program started. We're going to be working with charitable bequests. We're going to identify together your top prospects, your tier two prospects. We're going to get the solicitations out. I'll help you with the follow-up to those solicitations, whatever requests or information you get back from them. And we're going to keep that process going. We'll talk about exposing your board to planned giving. Everything you need to get your planned giving program started in 2021. We'll do it together. I'm going to have live trainings, which of course I'll record. So if you can't make the live version, we'll do small group Ask Me Anything sessions. I'm going to have a podcast exclusively for Planned Giving Accelerator members. There will be resources like samples of letters, samples of other advertising copy that you might put in your newsletter or your annual report. Samples of welcome letters to welcome people into the Recognition Society. That's another thing we'll talk about, creating your Recognition Society so you're thanking all your new planned giving donors. Everything you need to get planned giving started in 2021. I've been doing this since 1997. I know how to launch your planned giving program. I know how to start a program so that in 3 to 5 years and in out years beyond that, you've got the program that you want. I know what to do in the beginning, so that in the long term, you've got a successful, sustainable planned giving program. You know, I do webinars, and there's value in those. Of course, I don't make them empty shells. There's value. People know it. If you've listened to any of the webinars I've done, you know that. The accelerator is a much, much deeper dive. I mean, the webinars are, 45 minutes to an hour. Rarely even an hour and a half. The accelerator is a year-long program. And I'm estimating the person who is doing it with me in your nonprofit, and by the way, you can have up to 3 people in one nonprofit join, would spend about an hour a week. So you're looking at like 4 hours, maybe 5 hours a month max in the trainings and then in the follow-up work that you'll be doing on your own step by step as I'm teaching, right? Take a look at plannedgivingaccelerator.com. What I want to do with this is get 1,000 or 1,500 new planned giving programs launched in the United States. You know, I'm doing it to expand planned giving. I want to see so many more planned gifts and planned giving programs in the U.S. The average charitable bequest is about $35,000. So when all those 1,000 or 1,500 programs scale up to 100 gifts, when they get to that point, that's roughly, at a minimum, $3.5 billion new planned giving dollars for U.S. charities. That's what we're all about. That's what I'm doing this for. I want to help you get your planned giving program started. Join the accelerator. Let's do this all together. Let's get these new $3.5 billion new dollars for U.S. nonprofits from planned gifts. Expand planned giving in the country. Start it in your nonprofit. We'll be doing it together. All right. It's all at plannedgivingaccelerator.com. And that, my friend, is Tony's take two. And so the lesson is understand what the hell you're talking about.
Just on your own understanding, and make sure that you're asking questions from people who are doing the work every day. And right. And it doesn't mean you may have done the work. Right. But they're always, you know, people who they're doing the work then and there. And we need to make sure that we're asking the right questions so that we can get to the right solutions. You may be the expert. You may have done the work and you may have done the job. But you still need to, you know, add voices from the people even that you serve to make sure that you're coming up with the best solutions.
Yeah. How about another one?
Yeah. So another journey, I would say that was really important is, you know, powerful storytelling doesn't always have a great beginning. So there was a guy that I had a chance to interview that was with this nonprofit called Chrysalis Ministries. And they do, they help reduce the recidivism rate from people who are coming out of jail and in prison. And they do this through, you know, a series of classes like AA classes and NA classes, financial literacy classes. And they try to help people, you know, get back on their feet, even if they've maybe started out making some mistakes. So there's this guy, Jose, that was an athlete in high school. He got hurt and started to fall in with the wrong crowd. And he was getting bullied by this group. And because he was as sort of like a self-preservation, he decided to join the group. And so that led to him, you know, being in a gang. He started to sell drugs. He started to use drugs and he landed up in jail. And then he was in jail and then ended up getting in a gang in jail to also, you know, try to survive. And so we fell in with the Texas Syndicate, which, the Zeta cartel will use the Texas Syndicate sometimes to carry out contract work.
Contract killings, right? I imagine.
Yeah.
Contract beatings if you're not quite as bad as deserving of death. Okay, in the prisons.
Right. It was, but it was killings is the right word. And so this isn't the group you want to, you know, fall in with if you are trying to turn things around. So he ended up, you know, going in and out of prison. And the last time he was in prison for armed robbery, and he was facing 30 years. And what he did is decided he was going to turn his life around and join this ministry in prison that was a faith-based ministry. And he started to kind of share his own story, and you know, he was getting clean, obviously, and doing the work. And he ended up getting his sentence commuted to 12 years. And so when he got out, what he decided to do is he got hired by a nonprofit that was working at in Austin in Texas on the youth criminal justice reform. And because he had spent a lot of his youth in jail, in and out of jail, yeah, he could speak to what it meant to be in jail. And, you know, he had never gone to the Capitol before, and now he was meeting with senators, and sharing his story and sharing why, you know, things needed to be changed. And so here's a guy who, you know, had a hard past and made a lot of mistakes, and he could have run from that part of his life and not shared that part of his story, but he's now using it to do good for others. And it's an example of, you know, some of us struggle with our own personal story and the hard parts of our story, and we don't want to talk about it because we may even be ashamed of it, or maybe just really painful to talk about. And so what I want to communicate through this story is, no matter what you've been through, you know, you can always use that thing to be good for somebody else. And, you know, I've interviewed over 1,000 people in my career, and some of them have been through some of the worst things. You know, they've overcome homelessness, they've overcome addictions, they've had family members that they've lost, some of them children. And the one thing that they all have in common is that they're using that experience to try to make something good come from it. And so our stories have a way of, you know, if they're just in the dark, they can have a way of festering in the dark and continuing to cause a lot of pain for us. And when we can get to a point in our lives where we can share them, then that one thing that was a hard thing can actually, you know, help save someone's life or help change someone's life. And so those stories don't have to be wasted. And so I would say the first step to becoming a great storyteller is just acknowledging that you have one, that there's value in it. And that, you know, if you spend some time thinking about, you know, who you want to reach, and who you're meeting with, that our stories have a way of differentiating us, but also connecting us at the same time. And that can be very powerful.
Yeah. I love that point you make in the book. It differentiates because it's unique. It's unique to you. Your story makes you authentic and unique, but the broader lesson connects us to others as well.
Yeah, that's right. You know, nobody has exactly your same story, but there's parts of that story that are going to connect with people in different ways, and that may make all the difference. And I don't think we do it enough as leaders, not just in fundraising. I think it's incredibly important in fundraising. You've made a career helping people fundraise, but also, you know, and I have too. It's always leading with those stories that I think they're what people remember. You know, statistics are really important, and you can include stats, but it's not what people are going to like. Hey, did you hear about those statistics? That's incredible. They don't remember.
One of your tips is to avoid the what you call the curse of knowledge,
right?
You know, and have again drilling down to the simple, and not littering it with stuff that isn't really needed to serve the purpose. And again, you call it the curse of knowledge. You're stuffing too much in.
Yeah. And it goes back to what we're talking about, you know, when making presentations, it's just trying to simplify your message. And, you know, when you're making a presentation, you're doing a video, you know, really anything that's sharing your story, think about it as a trailer for the organization. You know, a movie trailer gets you excited to go see the film. You know, it doesn't give everything away. And right. I think that when you have the curse of knowledge, what you're trying to do is make what you're about to say connect with everybody in that audience, and giving them all the information that you know, to where you think, how could they not support me after I say all this? But when you're trying to be everything to everyone, you end up being nothing to everyone. And that's the thing is, trying to avoid that. And so we have a
movie trailer is a great analogy.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have an 80-20 principle when it comes to how we share stories. We're going to 80% of it is going to be aimed at the heart and try and create that emotional response. 20% of it is going to share measurable impact and, maybe dropping in a couple, bullet points here and there. But, if people get interested enough, they're going to go seek that information out, or it'll break the ice enough for them to ask you the questions where you can then give them a little bit more information.
Since you talked about, you just mentioned the heart and then the mind following, why don't you tell about the elephant and the rider?
Yeah. So this is pulled from a book that I recommend for any nonprofit leader. It's called Switch by Chip and Dan Heath.
Say it again slower.
Yeah, sure. Switch. It's Switch, How to Change When Change is Hard. Mm-hmm. And it's written by Chip and Dan Heath. They have a consulting firm. They're also college professors.
Right. Okay.
And have written, many really, really, really good books, some of my favorites. But they talk about this analogy of an elephant and a rider. And the elephant is sort of the emotional side of us. It's the one that, it feels pleasure, it feels pain, it's, maybe even more intuitive. And then there's the rider that is perched atop the elephant, that is more the planner, the strategic, person, the one that likes to thinks the container store has the answer to all of life, right?
I appreciated that in the book, because I happen to love the container store. Container store, Alpha. Oh, I wait for the January sale. I know it's 35% off sales coming every, 30% off sales coming every January. Even when they do the 25% off during the year, don't buy the Alpha then. Out for January and February, they do the 30% off Alpha every year.
You so, heard it here.
That resonated. I got a chill when it, yes, the container store. All right, but there's a much more important point than the container store.
Yeah, I'm all about the Alpha too, actually. We need a little more organization in our lives.
Oh, I love Alpha.
You would think that the person perched atop the elephant is in control. Right. But we all know that we only have so much control atop an elephant. And if that elephant wants to move in a certain direction, it's going to move in that direction. And you're just along for the ride. And so it's a very simplified explanation of this elephant and rider. But what they talk about in the book is what we need to do as leaders is we need to give the elephant a little bit of motivation, and we need to inspire that elephant so that it wants to go in that direction. And once it starts going in that direction, we need to do everything we can to clear the path. And so clearing the path means, if you're sharing your story, what are some misconceptions people may have about you and what you do? Let's clear the path by clearing up those misconceptions. But more importantly, let's give their elephant a little bit of incentive to want to go with you. And that comes through the right emotion behind sharing your story. And think about the reason we're drawn to the best novels, the best films, the best music. It's not about the technical side of how it was produced. I think we can appreciate that if we take the time to understand that part of it. And us, as some of the people who have the Alpha subscription, they may geek out on that, right? But the reason that we continue to be motivated is because of how it makes us feel. And we want to feel that, whether whether we're expecting to or not. That's what we remember. And it's the way a song makes us remember our childhood or makes us remember that great love. It's about how we feel. And so there are plenty of examples of in business, how that is true. too.
Time for our last break. Dot drives. Dot drives engagement. Dot drives relationships. Dot drives is the simplest donor pipeline fundraising tool. It's customizable, collaborative, intuitive. If you want to move the needle on your prospect and donor relationships, you want stronger, deeper relationships, get the free demo. For listeners, there's also a free month. Just go to the listener landing page at tony.ma/dot. We've got buttloads more time for Mommy Lied to God.
When we're advertised to by some of the largest companies in the world, you know, they're not speaking to our head, they're speaking to our heart. They want us to feel something. Just
why they do what they do, and less about how to describe what they do, but the why. Simon Sinek talks about that too. Mm-hmm. And you don't reference him in the book, but I was thinking about him as I was reading. Yeah. You know, he says people buy why you do what you do, not what people don't buy what you do. They buy why you do what you do.
That's right. Right. And, you know, here's the thing that nonprofits need to remember is, you know, the advantage that they have over for-profits is that the why is built into what you do. And it is why you exist. It is, you know, there shouldn't be any shortage of stories to tell if you're doing great work.
Yeah.
The challenge and, you know, is that, you know, we have to convince our boards to invest in our own story, you know, because we don't have the same kind of money that, you know, for-profits do, it can become a challenge. And marketing and sharing our own story, it's not invested in the way that it should be. You know, it is the one thing that will pay dividends. And it is what will continue to, you know, educate an uneducated audience on your work. It's your stories. And so that needs to be a constant investment. And I'll share this one thing. Not yet. That's my daughter. She just asked if it's lunchtime.
Oh, does she want to come over and say hello?
She left the room.
Okay.
So what I'll say is, you know, there are boards that will approve things like marketing directors. And so then they invest in a person, which is a great first step, but then they give them no budget to do that work. So if you have a marketing director and you've not given them a substantial budget, you know, a significant enough budget to be able to go out and do the work and create content to do the work, then you're putting yourself at a disadvantage. And so the person can't just sit there and, you know, create things, out of thin air. You know, it takes money to do that.
And that's so, that myth of do more with less.
Yeah.
Ridiculous. I never understood that. And now I just rail against it. it annoys the hell out of me for people suggest that we just do more with less. It's not possible.
Right. It takes money to do the work. And, you know, and it's, you know, you're already scrappy if you're a nonprofit leader, but you know, the executive director can't be all things, you know, and they're crucial to the mission. They're fundraising, they're leading the organization, you know, and many times they're also running the social media page and you know, you're doing the job of 10, if not more. Yeah. And so if you're going to make the investment and bring in somebody, if you believe that stories are important, then make it a significant part of what you do, and give it some time and see that it's going to pay dividends in the long run. You know, one other quick example of, as you've mentioned, sharing stories. There is a school foundation that I've worked with. I'm actually on the board of the foundation now, so I'm working with them in a different capacity. But we created a series of vignettes for them because they do these innovative grants. And so they fund, you know, these mini grants to teachers. Teachers will request a certain item and write the grant application. And then the foundation goes and has a committee. They select you know, what they can fund, and then they fund them. And so there was a story of this teacher that requested string instruments for his class. And so they got, you know, it got funded. There were violins and various string instruments that were provided to the class. And we just filmed him talking about it and filmed the students playing. And it was a very simple, he did a great job explaining what they do and what, you know, the growth he's seen come from having those instruments from those students. And it was a short video. The executive director, Judy Gilhead with the SAISD Foundation.
What's the name of the foundation?
It's the San Antonio, it's SAISD Foundation, San Antonio Independent School District Foundation.
Thank you.
She sent that video to the person who had funded that grant. It was the $10,000 grant. They had funded it and provided that donation through the foundation. And she said, hey, just wanted to say thank you for the support and wanted you to hear the story. She didn't say, hey, you know, we need more money. We're desperate here. She just sent it with a thank you. And within an hour, she got an email back from the funder that said, this is incredible. I want to talk to you about expanding this program district-wide. And so the $10,000 ended up turning into $100,000. And it was just a simple thank you. And it was just seeing the kids and hearing the story of the educator who was trying to provide an innovative experience, you know, for the kids. And so just, you know, give it a shot, use those stories, and don't ever stop sharing those stories because they're so important to the work that you do.
Is there a lesson specifically that we can extract from the Independent School District Foundation story? Maybe authentic or what else? What other of your tips fits in there?
Yeah, I would say it's, you know, just about understanding the importance of just keeping your investors aware of what you're doing through thank yous. If you're communicating to them 10 times throughout the year, you know, 8 of those times should just be thank yous and sharing stories, and maybe 2 of them are, you know, asking for money. And I think one lesson, you know, is also that, you know, we oftentimes, when we're thinking about creating content, are thinking about creating content for a new audience that is not invested in what we're doing. And that's important. You're always going to have an opportunity. You should always have an opportunity to bring new people into the work that you do, but don't forget about those who have been with you, you know, for since the beginning or the last 5 years. It's probably more important to keep those folks educated, because as we know in nonprofit world, you know, we know the same thing there as we know it is in business, which is it's way more expensive to get a new customer than it is to keep
retain one. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And even some of your donors may go back 25, 30 years.
That's right.
So all the more reason. Yes.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's all, you know, how are you educating their heirs, right? I think another huge problem that nonprofits have is that their funding base is aging, and that the next generation may not have the same priorities and, you know, goals as the generation before them. And so what are you doing to kind of bring in some of that some new leadership and maybe a balance of younger leadership and younger funders into the fold? Because, you know, it's important, right? Like you've got to constantly work at thinking about the next, you know, 10 years.
There's also an opportunity there for potential planned gifts among those folks that are aging. And that's what I do. All right. We have to leave with the last story, which has to be your signature story. The title of the book comes from this signature story. So we can't wrap without having that story. And so I think that's perfect. perfect one to end with.
Yeah, well, Tony, you built it enough, you built it up enough to where I feel like I do have to share it. For other people who have asked, I've said, you know, how the book got titled is in chapter three, and I want you to read chapter
three. Well, people, I'm going to say buy the damn book, because there's more strategies and tips and lessons than we were able to touch in an hour. So,
sure.
Yeah, but don't, I can't have you hold out on nonprofit radio listeners. It's not going to mean they don't buy the book, because there's more that we haven't talked about. So you got to get the damn book. Get it.
Yeah, that's true. Well, so the title of the book's Mommy Lied to God. And so one of the best lessons that I got when I started doing stand-up was from a friend of mine who at the time he was my roommate. And he said, look, if you're going to start writing comedy, you need to write about yourself. And because it won't sound like what everybody else is trying to say. And so it'll always be true to you. And when you perform it, you're going to perform it with just a different level of energy, because it comes from a place of truth, right?
Absolutely. So, all true. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And so, you know, it made a lot of sense to me. And that is one of the characteristics of authentic storytelling. And so, you know, when you're sharing your own story, or when you're presenting, you know, you pulling from your own experience is really important. But the hard thing for me at that time is that experience was, I was going through a divorce. And so how was I going to make an audience laugh about the most painful thing that had happened to me up until that point? And I think when I had the roommate, I wasn't even, you know, divorced yet. I was separated. So I'm talking about raw. I'm not talking about like thinking about 10, you know, even 5 years. I was going through it. And, so, you know, I decided to do it. I'd give it a shot. And so, you know, I wrote a couple of jokes like this. I was like, I'm going through a divorce. I wanted to work things out, but her boyfriend wasn't willing to compromise. You know, I'm like, let me see her on Wednesdays and every other weekend, you know, give me a month during the summer, you know, stuff like that. And then, you know, the mommy lied to God was, you know, the hardest thing about going through a divorce is being a single dad. Any single dad will tell you that if your kid doesn't get what they want, automatically they start crying for their mom. I said, okay. He was really upset. I said, I'm just going to talk to him. I said, son, I know you miss your mommy, but mommy doesn't live here anymore. It's like, why, daddy? It's like, well, mommy and daddy stood up in front of a room full of all our friends and family, and mommy vowed before God to be with daddy till death do us part. But see, daddy's still alive, honey. And that's right. Mommy lied to God. So I got quickly known as the bitter mommy lied to God comedian, right? The bitter divorced guy. And the thing about it is, you know, there's a lot more to the material, but you know, that thing that differentiated me was the thing that connected me with the audience of people who maybe had been through a divorce themselves, or their parents were divorced, or at least everybody knows someone who's been divorced, right? And so those were the folks that were laughing the loudest. And you know, I want to give a disclaimer. For one, I never actually said mommy. I never told my son that. In fact, you know, he only heard the joke recently when I was, and it's because I wrote this book and the book was coming out, right? And I could have easily titled the book Daddy Lied to God. I could have done that. But the reason that I was Mommy Lied to God was just, that was a part of my experience. And I told myself, if I ever write a book, you know, it's going to be called Mommy Lied to God. I think that, you know, it's important to think about those things in our lives that, you know, we naturally may shy away from, and know that, you know, sometimes embracing them, and using them to push ourselves forward is like the best thing that we can do. And so it was, you know, comedy was cheaper than therapy for me. I probably should have been in therapy, and I don't advise that if you should be in therapy, that you do stand up instead. We probably all know comedians that are like, oh, wow, you really need to talk to somebody, that's a professional. But the reason that it's true to my story is that, you know, through that experience, you know, it's led to the work that I do now. And you know, I truly believe in the power of sharing your story, no matter where it came from.
Carlos Maestas, get the book. Mommy Lied to God, Life Lessons in Authentic Storytelling. He's founder and chief story smith at Key Ideas. It's at keyideas.net and at Key Ideas Inc. And he is at Key Ideas Carlos. Carlos, thank you so much. Wonderful.
Thank you so much, Tony. It's been great talking with you, and hopefully we can stay in touch.
Real pleasure. I'd love to. Absolutely. Thank you.
All right, Tony. Take care.
Next week, Brian Saber from Asking Matters returns with his new book. We're sponsored by Turn 2 Communications, PR and content for nonprofits. Your story is their mission. Turn-2.co. Talk about storytelling. Do it for the media. And by Dot Drives. Raise more money, change more lives. Tony.ma/dot for a free demo and a free month. Our creative producer is Claire Meyerhoff. The show's social media is by Susan Chavez. Mark Silverman is our web guy, and this music is by Scott Stein. Thank you for that affirmation, Scotty. Be with me next week for Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Go out and be great.